vent, skidding backwards on his belly, being pushed by some giant hand faster and faster. The dim circle of light thrown by his helmet lamp showed the vent walls speeding past. Desperately, he tried to stop himself, dig his gloved fingers into the vent floor, but there was nothing to grab onto. He reached out sideways toward the tunnel walls, but the force of the wind tore at his hands, his arms, and he skidded along backwards, screaming now in fear as he slid down the vent like a feather caught in a tornado. Colonel Giap had climbed up onto the roof of his tractor's cab. There had been no word from Moonbase since he'd told Stavanger about the suicide bombers. His troops loitered around their vehicles, waiting for the inevitable. The ground had trembled twice, more than an hour earlier. Then nothing but silence and stillness. Giap looked at the watch on the wrist of his spacesuit. They're all dead in there by now, he thought. Dead or dying. I should send the troops in. Perhaps we can save a few. Something caught his eye. He blinked, not sure of what he was seeing. A cloud of glittering sparkles was erupting slowly from the hatch that opened into the plasma vents. The ladder that his troops had placed there toppled slowly like a stiff, arthritic old man, and fell flat on the crater floor in complete silence, sending up a puff of dust. It was like a geyser, Giap thought, but a geyser of scintillating little jewels that flashed and twinkled in the harsh sunlight. On and on it went, spewing slowly out from the plasma vent hatch across the dark lunar sky, 1,000,000,000 fireflies flickering in all the colors of the rainbow. Then something solid and heavy came shooting out of the hatch. Giap saw arms and legs flailing. A spacesuit. A man. One of the suicide volunteers, he realized. The body soared across the crater floor and landed with a thump that raised a lazy cloud of dust. It did not move once it hit. Giap stared, not knowing what to think, what to do. Another body came flying out, tumbling like a pinwheel, landing helmet first on the regolith. And then a third, limbs hanging loosely, already unconscious or dead. It fell near the other two. The studio. Doug stopped in front of the double doors marked Lunar University Video Center, Do Not Enter When Red Light Is Flashing. As he reached for the door pull, Gordette grabbed at his hand. Hold it, Gordette said. Look before you leap. Doug nodded and went to the wall phone next to the doors. Calling the control center, he asked for the security camera view of the studio. The wall phone's screen was tiny. It showed the panoramic view of the studio from the ceiling. Maximum zoom, Doug ordered, and pan across the room. The picture tracked across the studio, shadowy and dim in its spotty lighting. Cameras, monitors, racks of electronic equipment, the editing booth, empty. The sets where Zimmerman and Cardenas and others had given their lectures and demonstrations, also empty. The thought of Zimmerman sent a pang through Doug, but he swiftly suppressed it. Edith is in there with a crazy man, he reminded himself. That's what's important now. Hold it there, Gordette snapped. The camera stopped. Doug could see Zimmerman's extra-wide couch had been pulled from the wall. Edith and the space-suited suicide bomber were crouched behind it. Well, he's no fool, Gordette muttered. Dug himself in as far from the door as he could. Long as he stays behind the couch, I won't be able to snipe him. Have to spray the whole couch. And kill Edith? Maybe you can talk him into letting her... Uh-oh. What? Is that the best magnification we can get? Yes, Doug said. What is it? Squinting hard at the little screen, Gordette said, it looks like he's already got his thumb on the detonator button. So? That arms the detonator. When he takes his thumb off the button, the bomb goes off. Doug felt his insides sink. So if you shoot him, it explodes? Yeah. What can we do? Talk him into disarming the detonator. Doug knew how futile that was. Or into letting Edith go. Gordette inclined his head slightly in what might have been a nod. There is that. Anson peered at the screen showing the camera's view of the crater floor just outside the main airlock. Space-suited peacekeeper troops were gathering around the three unmoving bodies sprawled on the ground. "Two hit the nanolabs," she said, ticking off on her fingers. "One did the water factory, that's three. One's in the studio, that's four. And those three make seven. That's all of them." "The water's out of the factory," said the technician next to her. "Maintenance crews are reestablishing electrical power in the areas that were shorted out." Vince Falcone trudged into the control center, a bright grin slashing across his dark, stubbly face. Anson got up from her chair, yanked off her headset, and threw her arms around Falcone's neck. "We did it," she said, then kissed him soundly. Despite his swarthy complexion, Falcone blushed visibly. "Yeah, okay, we flushed out the garbage," he said. "But there's still one of the bastards in the studio, isn't there?" Colonel Giap was almost glad when he told Foray, "They have defeated us. There is nothing more we can do." Foray's image on the colonel's laptop screen was nearly purple with rage. "But there must be something. Your second wave of troops, the solar farms, something." Resignedly, Giap said, "If I send more troops into those tunnels, they will be blinded and neutralized, just as the first wave was. If I try to destroy their solar energy farms, they will engage us in a firefight that will cause unacceptable casualties." Then he waited 3 seconds, watching Foray's helpless frustration. "Perhaps the little man will give himself a stroke," Giap thought. Foray's reply was explosive. "Who are you to decide how many casualties are unacceptable? I am your superior. I make such decisions." "Throwing away lives will be pointless," Giap said. "I will not do it." As he waited for Foray's reply, Giap reflected that battles are won or lost on the moral level. One side loses the will to fight, and that's what has happened to me. Why should I throw away my troopers' lives for that pompous little politician in New York? To destroy Moonbase? To kill 2,000 civilians? "Are you saying to me," Foray replied at last, voice barely under control, "that you would refuse my direct order?" "I am saying that I will resign my commission before carrying out such an order," Giap said, almost surprised to hear his own words. "We could tear up their radiators," he thought, "or simply cut the pipes that connect the radiators to the inside of the base and then leave. That would take only a few minutes, and it would leave them to cook in their own waste heat. There would be no firefight, not if we left immediately afterward. But what good would that do? They would come out and repair the damage." "No," he said to himself. "Best to leave now while the entire force is alive and unhurt. The Sacred Seven have killed themselves, that's enough. No sense killing more." "It's me he wants," Doug said, reaching for the studio door again. "He'll trade Edith for me." "Maybe," Gordette replied. "It's the only chance we've got." "What's this wee white man? He wants to blow you away." "I can't stand out here and let him kill Edith." Gazing at him with red-rimmed eyes, Gordette said softly, "I know." Gordette seemed to relax. He let go of the assault rifle with one of his hands, holding it only by its barrel, letting its butt touch the floor. "You stay out here, Bam," said Doug. "If he sees you with the gun, he might touch himself off." "Yeah," Gordette said with a resigned sigh. "Go ahead." He watched Doug open the door and step inside the dimly lit studio, thinking to himself, Doug wants to die. He's ready for it. They worn him down to the point where he's willing to give them his life in exchange for hers. Then Gordette realized that it wasn't merely an exchange for Edith. It's for Moonbase, he understood at last. He's willing to give his life for ours, all of us. For Christ's sakes, he's willing to die for me. And what am I willing to do for him? Gordette asked himself. Then a new thought touched him. If he dies, what happens to me? The rest of the people around here don't trust me. They hate me. They'll even blame me for not protecting Doug. But what can I do? What do I want to do? Am I willing to get myself killed for him? Doug, meanwhile, had taken a few steps inside the dimly lit studio. He called out, "Edith, are you all right?" She rose to her feet slowly. "I'm okay." Her voice was shaky. The suicide